Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Herbert Wilson, 37237. I'm representing Mr. Dwayne Reimer, who is the appellant in this first matter before the court. He is present in the courtroom. Your Honors, first, Mr. Reimer, would like to just extend gratitude and thanks for the opportunity to have an oral argument today. We understand that this is something that you, as practitioners of law and, of course, judges, take very seriously, and so does Mr. Reimer. Your Honor, if I could sum up very quickly what this is all about as far as the appellant is concerned, Mr. Reimer, it's about promises. We think that this is a good and apt word to describe what's really going on here, because in simple terms, Mr. Reimer is asking the court to determine if the state followed its promises to Mr. Reimer and whether Mr. Reimer followed his promises, rather, to the state.
Mr. Wilson, before you get started, I wanted to ask more of a procedural question. In reading the briefs, do you feel that your opening brief complied with CAR 28K?
I think the initial brief probably had some technical difficulties, but we corrected those and resubmitted.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, in a plea agreement, everybody has to follow the promises, and if they don't, it's a breach. I think that that's simple contract law. I think it's applying here. Of course, in any agreement, we would want to look towards the four corners of a document if there was a document. Unfortunately, there is no document in this case that we reduced it to a writing. So the best that this court has is the records, the transcripts, any testimony that might be available. There was a plea agreement. Both the state and the appellant, Mr. Reimer, agreed that there was a plea agreement. The question is what was meant by the terms of that plea agreement, and is that possible to actually find in the record? So even though it was reduced to a writing, we can presume a couple of things. One is that we assume that the state would do its best efforts to follow through with the plea agreement, and Mr. Reimer would do his best efforts to follow through with the plea agreement. I think that those are implied terms, but they're automatically in any plea agreement, even if they're not specifically specified.
Mr. Wilson, I know that your time is very limited, so I just would like to cut right to the chase.
Thank you.
If I understand, and this is a, please correct me if I get this wrong, if I understand your argument, it's that because there was no express payment plan, that it was a breach of the plea agreement for the state to garnish Mr. Reimer's wages. Is that basically your argument?
That's a very good summary. We believe that because Stephen Green, the judge in this particular case, never specifically said, I want to garnish his wage, that term was off the table. Not that the state couldn't have done it. The state absolutely could have done it, Your Honor. But if they were going to do it, then they needed to follow process.
I guess you anticipated where I was going to go, because I'm having a little trouble making the connection that you're making here. Now, I guess I'll preface this by saying the court, and it's true, there was no specific payment plan. The court said that. But the court did repeatedly say, I'm expecting you to make payments. I'm going to do a six-month review. I'm right about that, correct?
You are indeed.
Okay. So let's assume, for argument's sake, that's what we have. I mean, it doesn't seem disputed, that the court made it clear, you know, I'm going to look to you to make payments. But let's assume we have just that. Why is that inconsistent with the state's right to garnish wages, which is a statutory right in a civil proceeding? I guess may I'm not being clear, but I'm trying. But I'm having trouble understanding the connection you make to go from no express payment plan to an agreement by the state not to garnish, which is a legal right that any citizen would have. So I'm having trouble with that connection.
To draw the connection, Your Honor, is that there was some kind of a plea negotiation leading up to where Mr. Groom, Judge Groom in this particular case, entered the plea agreement on the record orally. So we've got that language that's leading up to it. So Mr. Groom, no question about it, said, I am not going to institute a payment plan at this time, but I will reserve it sometime in the future. That gave the judge the opportunity at that point, Your Honor, to go ahead and change the deal on that particular piece of the puzzle at any time he so choose.
How so? How could he change? If you say the agreement was struck at the time of sentencing, it seems like he stuck with that. But the judge said repeatedly, you've got to make payments. You made representations to him that I read in the record that there will be payments made. They weren't made. You said when he gets a job, he'll start making payments. He got a job. He didn't make the payments. And then the state garnished. Isn't that the scenario of what happened here?
Not exactly, Your Honor, because what happened was that Mr. Groom said, Judge Groom said, I made it clear that through the record, I am not going to institute the payment plan, but I reserve the right to institute the payment plan. If the judge was going to do that, then he probably should have put it on the record, called the social status union and said, I'm going to have them garnish wages.
You're talking about the initial sentencing, he said.
Right, the initial sentencing, that's exactly what he said. And then he held to that. And not only did he hold to that, Your Honor, but he had a number of opportunities to change that and say, I am now going to institute a payment plan. The problem is Mr. Reimer didn't have a job. He was unemployed for many months.
August, of, I think it was 2009, is that the year that he was employed?
That's right.
He went back into court after that date, I believe it was October of 2009, and you said he has a job, you described the job, you told him what the potential for the job earnings were.
Right.
The judge says, okay, I won't institute a payment plan now, but I expect it to be paid. Isn't that what happened? You said out of his earnings, he will be paying.
Absolutely. And he did. He did put money aside in a trust account for the, for those payments. But Your Honor, you have to understand at this point.
Court trust account or in your trust account?
In the client, my client's trust account.
But he never, just as a factual matter, he never made a single payment after that first $5,000, correct?
Never made a single payment, Your Honor.
Okay.
Part of the reason why, number one, is that Mr. Reimer is unemployed. He's out there trying to work, earn money, and feed his family. He doesn't have any money. When he finally does get a job, he has a little bit of money that's available. He's earning $60,000 a year, so it's not a lot of money. He's in dire straits. He's trying to save his house. He's trying to make his car payment. He's trying to put gas in the car. He's trying to do the normal things. So at that point in time, if Mr. Groom or Judge Groom wanted to say, I want to garnish wages, he should have called in Mr. Reimer and said, I'm going to garnish wages. Why haven't you made a payment? Instead, what happened is that the probation department went ahead and just put in the garnishment, which, of course, ultimately led to the termination of the job.
But what was inconsistent with that? That's I'm not, you know, I know you're trying. I'm not sure I heard the answer to that. Why is it, okay, there's no payment plan. There's just kind of the courts leaning on Mr. Reimer to make payments. And nothing happens. The court is clearly frustrated. I think it was your predecessor counsel who was doing it at the time. And the court's leaning on him. You got to pay. I'm not real sympathetic here. You have an agreement that says inability to pay is not going to be a defense. You know, and they garnish. They have a legal right to do that. It seems to me, and I know there's law that says if there's any lack of clarity, it's the defendant's job to ask. But I'm still not understanding why. You don't have a legal duty to pay on this schedule. What is inconsistent with their garnishing his wages when he has a job?
What's inconsistent is that it was part of the plea agreement to begin with, that even though it wasn't reduced to a final writing, this is what was agreed to, and that is that Mr. Reimer has to be able to work toward building up or making this payment within the period of 2 years. Now, it makes sense that if he has the ability to make a substantial payment, he would have made the substantial payment. He didn't have the ability. It's not a defense. It's a reality, Your Honor. So at this point in time, the question of garnishment is not whether or not the state had the power to garnish. They had the power to garnish just like they have the power to arrest a person. But if they're going to arrest a person, they need to use the due process. And all that I think should happen in this case is that the state, or in this case, the court system should have said, we need to have a hearing on this. It's been 3 months since you started this job. You haven't made a payment. If you don't make a payment, we're going to garnish. That's not what occurred. Instead, the probation department simply rubber stamped the documents, sent them to this Department of Energy, the federal government. Mr. Reimer was fired 11 days later. That's where the critical nexus occurs. It's not that they had the power to, they did. It's the way in which it was done deprived now, in this case, Mr. Reimer, the ability to have a job that really enabled him to actually pay the money back in a timely manner.
What in the record, Mr. Wilson, shows us that? I mean, I know you've made allegations citing nothing in the record that he lost his job because of the garnishment. Is there anything, and that's a specific factual question, is there anything in the record that shows that to be true?
No, there's not. Okay. But that was never tried at the trial court, either in the 35C hearing or even before that when we had a revocation hearing. That was not an issue that was brought up, and I think it was sort of implied by Judge Groom, who's saying, well, I don't think it's our fault, I think it's your fault. And I think that is in the record, but there was no factual question that was raised, and there certainly wasn't any testimony or any kind of evidence that was proffered.
Thank you.
Was the garnishment served on your client?
It was not, Your Honor.
it was only served on the employer?
That's correct.
Usually garnishment, you don't think you've noticed to the garnishee so that he come and filed reverse?
You're supposed to.
So did you file any kind of motion in that civil proceeding to set aside the garnishment?
At that point, the damage had already been done. My client had already been fired, and he will never get a job with the federal government again. And that whole door is closed. So whereas we could have argued and made that motion, Mr. Reimer is, you know, looking at this saying, well, which is going to be the better option? And in this case, he realizes because he has such a short fuse and the amount of time that he has to repay this money, that it's now impossible. It went from being highly unlikely or improbable to being impossible once he lost that federal job. That federal job goes away, his hopes are done. So even if it's set aside, I think it's a tactical question, and I think it's a valid question, Your Honor, but it what's it really going to give him by way of effect? In that case, no. The state did not serve me. It certainly did not serve Mr. Reimer.
You may want to save some time, Mr. Wilson, but let me jump in and ask maybe one more question. It seems to me that your argument is kind of asking us to presume from the silence in the agreement that there was that the state had agreed to kind of defer trying to collect. How is that consistent with the Craig case, which is cited in the briefs, which basically says we can't presume from silence, you know, a term of the agreement unless it naturally, you know, whatever had to be in there?
Thanks for asking that question, because that goes really to the heart of my oral argument here today, Your Honor, and that is that we certainly distinguish the Craig Court because the Craig Court clearly spells out an objective test of the intentions and the manifestations of the party. There's no question about that. What happened in the Craig case was that this particular thing having to do with a parole issue, whether or not he had the right to parole or he didn't have the right to parole, is not something you normally talk about in that kind of a plea negotiation. Whereas whether or not there's a payment structure due was talked about. And in fact, Judge Green mentioned it specifically on the record. So this is a major issue. So whereas in the Craig case, it's sort of like, well, we didn't talk about that, but you don't have the right to do that. What I think is more important is Mr. Reimer's not asking for an exception to the law. All he's asking for is that the law be followed. And in this particular case, the objective test, based upon the record, was it was at issue. Whether or not Mr. Reimer has to make consistent monthly payments or whether or not the court had the right to at some point institute that, which I might add, Judge Green never did. He never said, I want a payment. I want a payment of this much money, and it's going to be consistent every single month, or I'm going to seek revocation. That's different than the Craig case. In the Craig case, what's going on here is that we didn't really talk about that, and since we didn't really talk about that, we didn't think because we didn't mention it, it would automatically be implied. That's not the case. It is on point here.
But Craig, the issue is mandatory parole, right? I mean,
correct.
The fact is they didn't talk about something that was legally required, and the court said, oh, I'm not going to assume we were going to do something illegal.
Correct.
There wouldn't be anything illegal here to not talk about garnishment or not garnishment.
That's exactly right, and that's our point, is that it's not illegal to garnish. But if the collection action is going to take place, then that's something that we already had talked about. Mr. Reimer's interpretation of that is a reasonable interpretation. And it's certainly reasonable because look at what the court did in the ensuing year, or actually years now. He never did sit down and say, I really want you to start making a monthly payment. I know that you're having a struggle, but I expect this. He could have done that based upon the reservation in the record originally. He never did. And so that obviously leads us to believe that that was not Mr. Grimm's intention. Mr. Grimm's intention was to allow Mr. Reimer every opportunity to work as hard as he could, and that if that 2 years elapses and you don't make that final payment, now I can go ahead and pronounce judgment.
Was the restitution payment made by September of 2010? I take it not.
It was not by Mr. Reimer. Of course, obviously, the... what happened was is the attorney's fund did pay that. The Supreme Court authorized the payment of that money.
So Supreme Court trust funds were used to pay off?
That did pay. It paid the two. It was authorized the $231,000.
But that isn't his money. That was money that we all put into.
That's correct.
Whole staff, whatever.
Money was paid, not Mr. Reimer's money, but.
So has his probation been revoked as a result of non-performance?
Not yet, Your Honor.
Is there a motion to revoke the probation?
There was, but it was...
No, since 2010. No, nothing's happened.
No. If please the court, I'd like to reserve the last 56 seconds. For...
Okay.
Thank
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Crane, and I represent the people in this case. My attorney registration number is 37842. The defendant's argument, of course, is that he should have been allowed by the trial court to withdraw his plea on the theory that the state breached the plea agreement when his wages were garnished. His argument goes something like this, as the court has already noted, and that's that because the trial court didn't impose a specific payment schedule at the time of the plea entry, therefore, any payments he would make were totally to be voluntary and unilateral on his part, and the restitution judgment itself was exempt from collection. That's, however, not what voluntary payment or no payment schedule means. That's not the same thing as saying that the parties, the creditors of this judgment of restitution were not allowed under the law anymore to collect the judgment at the time it was entered. For example, when money would start being paid to Mr. Reimer through his job, the ordinary course of the law, as was pointed out in my brief, is that the creditors, which in this case are the state and the victim, have the right to take appropriate measures to collect that judgment because it's a civil judgment. They could, in this case, garnish his wages.
Mr. Crane, if I can ask you a question.
Yes.
Let's take a different factual scenario. Let's assume it was absolutely clear that he didn't have to pay restitution until the deadline, two right. years, whatever it was, say, mm-hmm. make it up a date, August 31st, 2010. Uh-huh. That's when he has to pay it, and it was clear. Could the state still garnish his wages then? Was my question clear? You look a little puzzled.
I need a little bit more detail.
Okay. Let's assume that it was clear. He did not have to make a payment in the 2 years until the deadline. He was expected to make the full payment on August 31st, 2010, if that's the deadline.
And was that a term of the plea?
Yeah, let's assume that
one of the deferred judgment.
Let's assume, really, either way. Let's assume that's the agreement, that he doesn't have to pay until that date. And if he makes no payments in the first 2 years, that's fine. All right, let's assume those are the facts, and I know those are not necessarily the facts here. If that's the facts, could the state garnish his wages at that point? Would that be a breach of that agreement if they did?
I think it would turn a lot on the wording of the actual agreement, and if the agreement was that he didn't have to pay anything, and maybe I'm repeating my same point, I guess, if it's just that there's no payment schedule, I do not think that precludes the state from taking ordinary measures to garnish his wages if he's going to make money.
Yeah, and the first thing you said was what I was trying to ask. Assume the plea agreement or the conditions of the deferral were clear. He does not have to make a single payment until the deadline date,
right.
August 10, 2010, making up a date. Could the state garnish if those were the facts?
Yes, it could, because the question of whether or not he has to make payments on certain dates is a different question from whether or not the judgment itself is collectible at the time it's entered, which is at the time of sentencing by statute.
And that, in your view, would not be, it would seem to me the argument gets stronger for Mr. Reimer's side if those were the facts, and that's, I think, his interpretation of them, because there clearly seems to be an understanding from those facts that he wouldn't necessarily pay anything. And I think there's a pretty good argument that the government is doing an end run around their own agreement that he doesn't have to pay anything for 2 years. So maybe I guess your argument is it doesn't matter. So here, in this case, you could have garnished on day, first day you knew he had any income.
Well, I think they could have. And that's, as you mentioned, assuming first that this type of an agreement could be entered, that the state and the victim are precluded from garnishing on this judgment or otherwise collecting the judgment based on the plea agreement. And then it's also assuming that that term was part of the plea agreement in this case, neither of which I think is the case. But assuming that that is the case, then I still don't think it would be a violation because it comes down to the specific wording. If the wording was simply what we're talking about, and that's that there's not a payment schedule on specific dates that he has to make certain payments, that doesn't mean that his property or other money that he comes to take possession of cannot be collected. It just means that he's not in violation of the terms by not making payments on a certain date as long as he makes those payments. It doesn't mean that the state is not immediately entitled to collect on a judgment that's been entered. It's a little bit of a fine distinction. I'm trying to make
There's not an exact symmetry here. He could have been in violation of his agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it this way. He's not in violation of his agreement.
Correct.
By not making a payment on a specific date, but that doesn't mean that the people are in violation of the agreement by garnishing on a certain
date. Yes, that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I understand.
Is there any, and it's a factual question, and I do recognize we do not have the full transcript of the sentencing proceeding in this record. Was there any discussion on the record that we have relating to garnishment at all until the wages got garnished?
No.
All right. And do you agree with what Mr. Wilson said, that Mr. Reimer was not given or served a copy of the garnishment?
I have no way of knowing whether or not he was served a copy of the garnishment. I do know that appropriate procedure, as the court pointed out, would be dispute the garnishment, but I don't know whether that happened or not, or whether he received a copy, or whether it went to some other address because of improper, you know, notification of address changing as house foreclosure or whatever. I really don't know.
Thank you.
I guess I'll just note it is correct that there was no proof of causation between the garnishment and the termination from employment. The defendant had the opportunity to attempt to prove that matter at the hearing below in this 35C hearing. No proof was presented, and the trial court found that not proven and also doubtful that that would have been the case given the fact that the defendant was working for the federal government and had a felony conviction for, you know, relating to embezzlement. I assume his role at the U.S. Department of Energy was some sort of an auditing role. Craig, again, I think whether or not the issue here is a question of illegality of a term of a plea agreement, I agreed with the statement that the court made. I think the distinction that the statement in Craig is applicable, that we can't just read in a term or find ambiguity in agreement when there's no discussion of a term whatsoever in an agreement. The question of what the plea agreement means is a question of law. It's determined by the meaning that a reasonable person would assign to the judgment or to the agreement under the circumstances. And in this case, there was nothing to do with garnishment or precluding the victim or the state from collecting on this judgment.
Agreement modified by any of the representations or statements made by his counsel or by the state or by the judge in that October 2009 hearing when he was called in?
The probation revocation hearing?
Yeah, if you call it that, I guess that's what it was. It was more like a show cause hearing. I don't know that it was really probation.
That's correct. I guess it was. I think there was
a show cause why payment hasn't been made, is what I understood.
Why a schedule shouldn't be imposed.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I don't think there was a change in the terms or modification of the terms of the agreement based on what was said at that hearing, because the only thing that the trial court said at that hearing was, I didn't impose a payment schedule at the time. I could have. I have not done so yet, and therefore, I'm not going to impose a payment schedule at this time. Well, therefore, I can't terminate probation at this time, is what I understand the trial court said at that hearing was, there wasn't a payment schedule in place. I reserved the right to do so. Therefore, he's not in violation of probation right now.
There were representations made at that hearing that he now has a job, however. Were there not?
I don't recall, honestly, but by his counsel?
Yeah.
I don't recall. If it was, I'm not aware of any other employment that was discussed other than this position with the Department of Energy. But
that's what I meant. That he now has a job, he's in a position to be able to pay. Which is what I thought triggered the garnishment when he didn't pay by November.
That's what I would have thought, or that when that job was reported to probation would have, you know, notified their appropriate people to enter an order of garnishment and start collecting.
Wasn't the direction from the district attorney to the probation people to garnish the wages, was there?
There's no evidence of that. I don't think that's how it's normally works.
Probation did it on their own. And you say the creditor himself could have garnished?
Under the restitution statute, the restitution is a final civil judgment in favor of the state and the victim. That's why I question whether or not it's appropriate or legally possible for the district attorney and a defendant to make an agreement that restitution is not collectible at all for 2 years.
Is it necessarily bound by that plea disposition?
Right. It's not a party. I don't think we need to get there in this case, but I think it raises some...
It's an interesting issue, though.
Yes. If no further questions, I'll thank the court for its time and ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Just a couple points of clarification. First of all, the question, I think, it arises in the minute order towards the end of the 35C hearing. Mr. Graham, actually, Judge Graham, does explain that, again, reaffirms all of what we've said, and even then had the right to go ahead and say, if this is the case, I'm going to institute a garnishment action. He doesn't even do that there. The second thing is that probation department was always aware of Mr. Reimer's employment. He has to report to them monthly. They were quite well aware of where he was at, how much money, if he was earning any money. He has a duty to do that. Vis-a-vis, the court would have known the exact same thing. So this wasn't a secret. They knew exactly where he was at, exactly what he was earning, and what he was doing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.